I promised myself I would put something under the edge of this table because when a speaker is speaking, this is off the record, the wobbliness can drive one. Better. It's good to see you again, brethren, this morning, to be with you and fellowship, to see some of you we did not meet with yesterday, and a joy to be with you. We still bring you love from your brethren at New Brunswick, bring you love from Brother Dean Oswell in Africa, and other brethren along the way, including our brother Eliezer in Uganda. And you may have heard that there was a crisis in Myanmar, Burma. And we had a chance to speak with the brother there. He was safe, but his activities, witnessing activities, have been crimped because of no electricity and no transportation. But of course, his countrymen, as you know, are suffering the physical strife of the cyclone that went through that area and the tidal surge that devastated their community, took many lives. One more thing that we have good reason to pray for the kingdom when these things can be subdued completely and the Lord would overrule the blessing and healing, as we have prayed for, of the nations. This is a section called the Fourth Enemy, the Nominal Church. Is it the is the channel, this was a channel at one time, that went bad still a danger? And that is a key question, and thank you, dziękuję bardzo. I'm afraid something's tickling my throat. I hope I do not annoy you too much with it. So what is this fourth enemy? Well, we know the world, the flesh, and the devil. These are three enemies. But it's interesting that at the conclusion portion of the Foes and Besetments in Volume 6 of the New Creation, the Foes and Besetments, after dealing with the world, the flesh, and the devil, Brother Russell has a small subhead entitled The Nominal Church as an Adversary of the New Creation. You know, he says, and you can look at your handout for this, it's printed on your handout, there is a continual temptation to the new creation by the nominal church system, not only through false doctrines, but also in formalistic piety and hypocrisy. This is an observation Brother Russell made in his day, we suggest that it has not left the scene. In the second portion of this, we call to mind that the nominal church combines the worldly spirit, its aims, its ambitions, with the name of Christ, and this makes things even more complicated because here it appears to be something that is Christ-oriented, and it turns out that it is worse than that because it is involved in many allurements. Seeking honor of men, freedom, sacrifice, we've heard the mention of freedom before, but baits, freedom from sacrifice, but it's a different kind of freedom, baits and allurements, snares and traps. And then we notice this expression, no others of the adversary's snares is so alluring or are so alluring, so deceptive, so powerful as this one. Now, that again was written in the late, the early 1900s, and it made us think this morning as we read today's Mana text, and we read part, if not all, of the article, some of us, reprint 2534, talking about the time of Nehemiah, talking about the time of Malachi, that there was problems in Israel. Those who had come back had become engrossed again with the people of the land. This is a concern because that meant God's holy people, the people who are covenant people, were drifting into an experience again with the people of the land, much the way Solomon married the wives, and now the priests were even divorcing and marrying these women of the land. The condemnations in Malachi, the condemnations by Nehemiah, all are part of this. And of course, Ezra went through this period with them and the struggles they were faced with. All of that is part of why we're looking at this and more. Brother Russell says, none so powerful as the nominal church. Why? Because the adversary has used this tool to work over the saints since the early part of the age. The nominal church literally supplanted the true church of Christ, misrepresenting God, misrepresenting Christ, as well as the teachings of the apostles of the Lamb, the 12 apostles. And the result of this behavior, this misrepresentation, led on the one hand to discouragement, On another hand, to dwarfism, Brother Russell uses this concept, unrestrained carnality and worldliness, association with the world in a very, very direct way. So the result of the tares being sown in the early church produced monstrous hybrid-like look-alike, Christian look-alikes. You know, this is the period about which Richard Rubinstein wrote a history. The history, some of you may have read this, actually. It's a small booklet, book rather. It's called When Jesus Became God. Now you might say, when did that ever happen? But in fact, there is a book written by a Jewish man who stumbled on this subject one day and decided he was going to probe it. He very clearly shows how the church people of the 4th century managed to foster a problem among the Christians, made things a lot worse than things were, and these are the folks that solidified the Christian Roman church the way it appeared to be in the early years and the way it has stayed. They banned Arianism officially by the 380s, and they also began to forge what became known as the Trinity. This all goes on, and that's why he titled his book, When Jesus Became God. These are the folks that gave us this kind of problem. These are the folks that provided with doctrines that would be not only heinous, but would also be the basis for behavior of their followers. Because doctrine begets behavior. Doctrine begets many things. If it's bad doctrine, it can be very evil, as you'll see. So the question would be, why would we be concerned as Bible students now? Some of you in this room have several generations of family going back to Brother Russell's day. I know of one young person that I can trace they're consecrated, they're very young, but their family is traced back and even mentioned their family names in the reprints. Sixth generation. Now why are we worried now about the nominal church, the sixth generation for at least one person that I know of, and fifth for several others, at this late date? What could possibly be a danger to us, if anything, from this Babylonish source of difficulty and energy? Well, first of all, we don't believe the system has collapsed. It's not completely gone, and that's one reason why we should be alert to it. From a January 1st, 1900, Views of the Towers, we read, and this is on handout 2A. If you look at your handouts, it's number 2A. The collapse will be sudden and awful, and when it does come, and while only few realize the fallen from grace condition of Babylon in the present, none will be ignorant of her collapse when it comes, suggesting that that has not happened clearly. So in handout part 2B, you'll notice a reprint 2554, where Brother Russell says, we're looking yearly for the final knot to be tied in some manner with the Protestant denominations, the Episcopal Church, and so forth, with papacy. Image of the beast, receiving life and vigor and energy to be made active. The activity will seem to be promising great things for Babylon, actively suppressing liberty will occur, and the powerful will be exerted powerfully against the spread of truths now published by us. Now, we ask ourselves a question. This is in a sense, parenthetically. Let's take a look at that slide. In Brother Russell's day, there was a political cartoonist named Thomas Nast. This is a picture from Harper's. I believe it's 1881. If not earlier. I don't have the date visual to myself. Can you blow this up in the corner? Right there. 1871. You can see that this is the way it appeared the year before Brother Russell comprehended the idea of restitution. Okay? Now let's back out, Brother Raphael. I wanted to show you this because there are some very interesting things in here. First of all, this is a political cartoon which shows, number one, that they're calling this the American River Ganges, okay? On the right side, you see a man. He has a Bible stuck into his vest. He is protecting the children against some monsters coming ashore. Up on top of the hill, there is a flag flying. It happens to have been published in the United States. When you fly the American flag upside down, it means danger, disaster, worry. Okay, back here, there are people being thrown over the edge. The school teacher is being taken over to be hanged at a gallows. And let's go back now to the other side. Over here in the distance is a building This is a political situation. It's Tammany Hall, the Democratic Hall in, or the Hall of the Democratic Party, or the Democratic Party of Democrats in, in. But now this turns out to be, let's move to the right, brother, or push to the, yes, to that side. Let's go over here. Over here, the political, whoops, too far. The political Roman Catholic school. Basically, it's the Vatican. Okay, now, why am I showing you this? Well, let's go to the center again and go down by those creatures, okay? I'm showing you this because while Brother Russell was predicting that the Roman Church would join with the Protestant churches, no one in their right mind would have said he was correct. Why? Let's rotate this one, Brother Raphael, vertically. You see those monsters? Let's get it to go up. Okay, let's close in on those monsters. Closer, 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 closer. They are what? They're priests. Now tell me something. You're a Roman Catholic. You're looking at Harper's in 1871. How do you feel? A little offended? But Thomas Nast, and you can rotate it back again, was defending the, quote, Protestant American public school concept. Whatever it was, he was trying to defend it. And this is the way he did it, and he described, essentially, in this imagery, how Americans felt about Catholicism. So let's go back to the Chart of the Ages, which is a much, much nicer concept. My reason for showing you this is because in Brother Russell's day, this was a complete impossibility that there could be anything like a union between. He's teaching us that it would happen. We have seen, since his day, a reversal of this policy. First of all, they wouldn't let something like this in print without a great deal of outcry. Secondly, the churches have shared pulpits with these people, and they're moving in the direction of a greater and greater ecumenism almost every year. And there's more to come on that, but I did want to mention that and show you that. Let's look at handout 2C. There will be a great triumph, he suggests, of churchianity after the war, meaning World War I. Now notice, this is printed here because we want to emphasize that Brother Russell did not change his mind that there would be a rise of church-state, of some kind of combination. And he uses the expression, we'll refer to it later, some kind of cooperation between the government and the churches. Okay, we just want to emphasize that detail. Toward the end of this handout 2C, but the triumph of Babylon will be short. Notice he uses the word Babylon. He expected it to be there. And soon the sentence already pronounced will be executed, and she shall fall like a great millstone into the sea, into anarchy, into destruction, never to rise again. Notice this is 1916. This is not 1878, 1914, 19, and so forth. After the war, he says, serious persecution for the true church. And we observe it was a 1916 item. And we also recognize that it is something that he expected soon. Clearly, he expected the church to go home before 1920. We'll talk more about that later. We want to know our enemy, brethren. We want to know the history of this satanic situation. Various reasons. One reason, of course, is Brother Russell goes through the whole discussion of the Man of Sin chapter, but not just for the purpose of showing that it's an evil system. He goes through it for a different purpose. What does he go through it for? Goes through it to point out that the Lord can be present, that we're not waiting for the man of sin, as some were teaching. What's the present status of this enemy? Is it still alive? What will come of it in the future? Is there any redeeming, sanctifying benefit to even reviewing this concept? Do we have any responsibility regarding our understanding of such an enemy? Let me ask you this question. Has the Babylonish system ever been beneficial to the Lord's people? The only benefit it may have had is to test them, to try them. Before the church became a harlot system, before that early church became a harlot system, it was a channel of truth. It was a virgin waiting for her bridegroom. And nevertheless, she abandoned that bridegroom and chose to bind herself to the kings of earth. You know that. And then this apostate church system made her mixture by which she intoxicated the kings of the earth. She was mixing a cup, not the Lord's cup. She was mixing a cup of these evils. Instead of the concept of sacrifice she was called to share in, she was moving in a different direction entirely. And she became this harlot system. A dreadful system. Brethren, at no time did Babylon ever produce or beget saints. No, never, not ever. No one was begotten because of Babylon. Brother Russell says, and it's in handout 2D, notice the statement, Brother Russell's words, tares cannot beget wheat, nor can nominal Christendom produce true Christians. It never happened. They were produced there in spite of Babylon and all of its evils. That's reprint, I should say, volume 6, page 654. So saints are begotten in spite of Babylon, but they're separate in spirit from that system. And only in the harvest were they literally called to come out, warned to separate, not just in spirit, but now in fact, in reality, physically get out. When we recognize the article that Brother Russell has, January 1st, 1900, it's a worthwhile article to go back to and read about the Federation that Brother Russell was concerned about, which he found lingering. Begettal, we believe, only occurs past or even present because of God's Holy Spirit. Begettal becomes because of the word of truth, and that's only found in the scriptures. James 1:18, we remember the words, of his own will begat he us with the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. God's truth begets new creatures. Babylon's error doesn't. It never did. It never will. Error, on the other hand, prevents sanctification. And this is a critical matter. We must remember this. Error prevents sanctification. Every error endangers the saints, weakening them, leading them through the deceptions that were mentioned by Brother Lawrence just before we have spoken. The deceptions that would be very enlivened even at the end of the age. And clearly the nominal church has been the true church's enemy throughout the gospel age. I do not believe that it has stopped becoming an enemy in 1878 or 1914 or 1918 or yesterday or even this morning. It's still our enemy. And perhaps the only redeeming value that we mentioned before is that it has been used to test the mettle of the true saints. So how did such a system come into existence? Well, you remember the parable of the sower, and I'm just going to be very brief about this. The Lord sows good seed. The enemy, while the men sleep, the apostles fell asleep, sows this tare seed. And of course, what happens is they begin to grow together. Now, shall we run in there and pluck out the tares? No, because you'll damage the wheat. But you wait until they have ripened, and then you pull the tares, and you also save the wheat from this system. And they will be dealt with as another subject of our discussion could go into, but we won't take the time now. Apostle Paul said the mystery of iniquity already works. And yet John says, this is the last time, and you've heard that the Antichrist shall come. So in one sense, the system was growing, but as we know from Thessalonians, the Roman government was literally restraining it. And one of the things that I would strongly encourage the brethren to do is to look at reprint page 306. And 306 has a section of an article entitled Picture of the Counterfeit of God's Kingdom. And that's what Revelation 12 was. It's extremely important to understand Revelation 12 correctly because that opens the rest of the book of Revelation to us to make much more sense. If we have that mixed up, it's not going to work as well. Now, we mentioned again the churches yesterday. Brother Lawrence mentioned them again. The third church, Pergamos, thou hast there in them that hold the doctrine of Balaam. What's the doctrine of Balaam? He basically convinced Balak that the best way to get a hold of Israel and get them to be cursed is to kind of mingle with them and have your children marry their children and they essentially commit fornication in their level of activity. Well, that's what Nehemiah, Ezra, and Malachi in this morning's manna text in the article is referring to, if you can go back to it. It's reprint 20, 25, 34. I recommend reading the whole article. Thyatira, Revelation 2:20, where you suffer, that church suffered the woman Jezebel to teach and seduce my servants. Sardis, there's a few names in Sardis which have not defiled their garments. Things have gotten to a very bad ebb. As Brother Lawrence mentioned this morning, it wasn't until the fifth stage that things started lightening up a bit and you had some sense of reformation. Now, the fourth enemy of the true church not only discouraged them spiritually, but also destroyed their hopes because of this misrepresentation of God's character and plan. And then on top of that, even more, they persecuted them. They put them through enormous pain and difficulty. I think you recognize it was in at least one reference on volume two, page 346, that Brother Russell refers to what has happened during the past 1,300 years. Brother Russell refers to 50 million people possibly being killed at the hands of the systems and their adherents. But you see what it is the doctrines gave these individuals their go-ahead. If you believe that people are going to be tortured in hell forever, what's a few hours of burning at the stake? Or roasting like they do with Michael Servetus? There's just nothing wrong with it, obviously. If anything, maybe you'll get them to confess the truth and then they'll be okay. Burning in hell a little less, maybe. But the point is, if you know if this is what God's plan is, what's the difficulty? You can very easily do these wicked things. So the great religious systems, the clay that gets mixed in with the imitation stone, in Nebuchadnezzar's image, and as is mixed in with the church state community, that image, we believe, was struck in 1914, ending the lease of power to the Gentiles. But we find Brother Russell describing this Babylon churchianity system still very much functioning and as an evil problem in his closing article writings and in the foreword of 1916. Brethren, we mentioned this yesterday. We, in speaking with those who are in the nominal church systems, we who speak with them, we recognize that they need to take the whole counsel of God. But even amongst ourselves, we need to take the whole counsel of Brother Russell. So when we look at the 1916 foreword in Volume 3, and he says whether the date 1914, so clearly marked in the Bible as the end of the lease of the Gentile power or permission to rule, would mean that there would be fully out of power, or whether that was the lease was expiring and their eviction begun, we're looking here at a statement in the foreword, in the 1916 foreword, that suggests that the latter, this is in Volume 2, page Roman numeral 3, that he was looking for the eviction to continue from that point on. But then notice also, he said this is in Volume 2 again, page 356, a few pages later than the earlier quotation we gave. In the final death struggle of Antichrist, he shall seem to be gaining increasing power in the world by new stratagems, deceptions, combinations. And we'll emphasize the word combinations. See, when we looked at the picture of this very anti-Catholic attitude of the people in the United States, and there was a lot of it in the 1800s, as improbable as it was in the pastor's day, we quote from page 360 in Volume 2. Improbable as this cooperation of Protestants and Catholics may seem to some, we see unmistakable signs of its rapid approach, whereby politicians are willing to cooperate with papacy, are assisted into prominent positions in government affairs. And I think we've known that this is a very reality in our day, that there is much to do now, even with whether it be in this country or any other, that cooperation with church is evident. One very vivid example of this is the fact that Vladimir Putin, former head of the KGB, wears a cross. Why is he wearing a cross? Well, he's very close to Alexei II, who is the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church. Why is he doing this? Has he really gotten religion? Is he a born-again KGB agent? What do we have? No, it's politically correct and politically advantageous for him to bind himself with a group of people who are also feeling for the souls of the Russian population. And how better to run a country than to have both the state and the church cooperating? A combination of sorts. That's an example. By the way, did you know that the Russian church considers it much more pure than the Roman church? In fact, they consider themselves the only pure church. It's probably one of the reasons they've kept their distance from the Roman Catholic Church, although there's been some changes in that area as well. Okay. Brother Russell made these statements. Some might suggest that he's speculating. We don't believe he was speculating. We believe he looked at the scriptures. We believe he had it lined up logically, and that certainly, you know, he was even looking to the possibility of these things extending beyond his day. Do you remember the quotation from reprint 4530? Whether this age ends October 1914 or a century later, our faith will be equally clear. That's an interesting statement. So, what's even more interesting, as my brother-in-law pointed out to me recently, do you remember that this was a statement that was made in 1909? And he's thinking in terms of a century later. But of course, he wasn't talking about 1908, 2009. Did I say 1909? 1909 to 2009 would make it this next year. But Brother Russell was really speaking in terms of 1914 to 2014. Parenthesis. That's not a new date, brethren. Please, do not even think that way. But in fact, it is something to keep in mind, that Brother Russell could project in his mind, our faith would continue however long this takes. Okay. He also saw the plain facts that by 1914, the churches did not have this vitalized image of the beast of Revelation chapter 13. He expected new combinations. And he said in 361 of volume 2, there would be a time when some simple law of religion, even in this land of liberty, the United States of America he was speaking about, in which personal liberty would be curtailed under the plea of necessity. Not exactly the same, but isn't it interesting how an act of law was not liked but specifically welcomed because of the necessities of this whole age of terrorism? A Patriot Act, and all of this associated with necessity. It can shut down a society if it chooses to. Now, the fourth volume spoke about the combined power of church-state, federation of Protestant churches, and Brother Russell also spoke there about methods of persecution. But he spoke of them as being more refined, somewhat like you'd go to a dinner and someone gets, quote, roasted with words. They get, they're kind of joked about and so forth. That's the kind of roasting that one was speaking about. He did not see the Holocaust. You see? He did not know that people would be put into buildings, although they had been earlier in time, but put into buildings and literally burned to death. He was living in the Victorian era. There was a sense of dignity, a civilization. I doubt if Brother Russell had any clue that even in his very day, when the American armies were, the United States armies were in Spain, excuse me, Spain's property, Philippines, they were using something called the water cure, which was developed by the Jesuits in Spain to torture people to get them to confess. The water cure sounds an awful lot like something else we've heard of lately called waterboarding. And that means, and I don't mean surfing, by the way. That means, of course, where you essentially create the mind thinks you're drowning, and you are willing to tell them anything instead of drown. What does this mean? Brother Russell in Volume 4 uses this language by comparison to the roasting that we mentioned. He said, for a time, the wheels of liberty and progress will be turned backward, and medieval restraints will be considered necessary for self-preservation, for the maintenance of present order of things, and for the prevention of a new order which God has decreed. That's Volume 4, the foreword, Roman numeral, page 12. What are medieval restraints? Were they refined? I don't think so. Remember Napoleon's soldiers going in, what Brother Russell told us about that. They went in there and they were horrified what they saw in those various torture chambers in the monasteries. The evil that men does is incredible. Please look at handout number 5 to take our minds back to something more productive and positive. With all of that as the possibilities of the future, and that may not be our experience, we may leave the earth in this flesh a lot sooner than anything like that comes to the true church in the close of the age. But notice, are we studying daily and meditating? If we are, we will be energetically taking advantage of our present trials and blessings. Trials and blessings. Because we're using the time to build ourselves up to deal with these trials and blessings. Are we praying continually and watching sensitively for the Lord in our lives? Are we witnessing fearlessly on every possible occasion, both inside and outside of our personal comfort zones? Are we keeping our robes unspotted, cleansing ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit? Are we continually going to our advocate, whoever liveth, to make intercession for us? You know, these 5 points can be extremely helpful as we try to walk in this soiled life that we have around us. We are in contact with unbelievable problems, trials, temptations, allurements of every kind, shape, and description. It would do us well to not only be aware of them and to avoid them and to pray as we see something coming, but also to watch our own personal conduct, our words, by making, even sometimes the brethren have joked, making innuendos. We've heard words like this among the brethren. A joke at a dinner table, a comment at a wedding, things that are, how could you say, they're slightly with double meaning to them. We have to be careful because it may not affect us, but what is it doing to our brethren? Are we stumbling them? Are we making them think of things that are improper? By the way we act, by the way we speak, by the way we close our eyes and open our eyes, and the way we smirk and smile and wink and everything else. Just, I don't want to make anybody paranoid. Brother Lawrence was right. We don't want to scare anybody. But we have to think, what are we doing with everything in our life that has its impact on our brethren? We have liberty, but, you know, what does Paul say? I would not eat meat until the world ends, I'm paraphrasing, if I would might stumble my brethren. So our fourth enemy is out there. But you know, it's going to work with the flesh. The world, the flesh, the devil, they all work together, and the nominal church will use that too if it has an opportunity, through fear or whatever. This new pontiff, which was mentioned earlier, Benedict, you know what his job was before he became pope? He was in charge of the College of Faith and Doctrine. Do you know what its old name used to be? The Inquisition. If anything, he was the Inquisitor General. Now, they don't go around doing things like that, as far as we know anymore, but that was his job. Changes are occurring even in Protestant churches. Did you see the article a few years ago in Time Magazine about Mary being included as a statue in some Protestant churches? Amazing, but it's true. It was happening. Mainstream churches. Attendance dropping. Evangelical churches, it's rising. It's rising so much even in Russia that one Russian priest on television said to his people, the Protestants are as bad as those who killed Christ. They're trying to make a wall around the Russian church and keep the Protestants out or down. If you don't understand what's happening in countries where Orthodox churches are, speak to some of the brethren who come from Romania, Ukraine, Moldova, and maybe even from Russia, where the Orthodox church is feeling its oats, as they say, and getting active again. How much of an enemy is this system to us today? It's true. The churches. There was a photograph of George Bush standing with the priest or the minister of a church in Europe. He and Laura and the minister. Beautiful, huge cathedral-type building. But the point was is that nobody comes. Well, doesn't that mean that there is nothing going to happen? No, it doesn't necessarily mean that. I see this fellow Benedict as doing the following. He's thrown the gauntlet down regarding Islam. And they have thrown it back in his face by saying, you're starting a new crusade. Well, it would not surprise me if his attempts to kind of cleanse Europe from Islam doesn't lead to some difficulties and problems down the line, one way or another. I'm not prophesying. I said it wouldn't surprise me, because he knows very much what Islam can do, will do, and he's worried about his, quote, flock in Europe. Now, we know also that the mother of harlots, when you have the stone smiting the image, it essentially loses its 10 toes, doesn't it? It doesn't seem to have that connection. But, you know, Jezebel's sons lived after Ahab. The first son died, and you can read the story, I think it's in 2 Kings chapter 1. It's a very unique experience where the son falls through a lattice, and Elijah's involved in this. But the point is, he lives after his father, and then the other son lives after, and finally Jehu, you'll know, kills him. And also, of course, this just precedes Jezebel being thrown out of the window. So there is some activity post the death of Ahab. So if we picture Ahab as being part of this ten toes image, there is still some liveliness afterward. In fact, if you remember, in Revelation chapter 17, verses 3, 7, 11, 12, 13, 16, rather, you're talking about an experience in Revelation 17 where there is this woman trying to associate herself with 10 kings who have had no kingdom as yet. Something was future after the other image. And I'm mixing pictures here, I'm sorry for that, but it's perceived that they had no kingdom as yet, implying that something happens in this end of the age which is different from what was happening throughout the age. That's the point of it. So how is she really doing today? Take a look at handout 6, point 6 on your handout. There's 3 or 4 points here I'd like to go through rather quickly. One of them has to do with the day of pardon. This is when the Catholic Church apologized for something. Well, their apology was a non-apology apology, because although they apologized for the children of the church, they did not apologize for what the church did. The church had its fingers in a lot of these pies and wasn't apologizing for the church's sins. It was apologizing for the children of the church and what they did. You can read this Angelus Day of Pardon a little bit later. The concept of separated brethren. You know Brother Russell's treatment in Volume 4, where he explains very clearly how the Catholic Church is basically cooperating with the Protestant churches. And then it was the more liberal Presbyterians who were very active in trying to pull everybody together. In fact, they called in all the world's religions to find if they could learn something from these wise men of the East. You remember those statements? Well, the Catholics spoke of us, not us, of the Protestants as being separated brethren. But notice number 7. You have a joint declaration on the doctrine of justification. Luther's key, the doctrine of justification, and his clergy is now, those who followed him, are now making an agreement with the Catholic Church in principle that they agree on the subject of the doctrine of justification. Some in Time magazine years ago, when the bishops were tying themselves in with the Vatican, someone wrote in Time magazine that Luther must be turning over, if he could, in his grave. But there is another part. There is the two-horned beast. This is from Revelation chapter 13, verse 11, where it begins this process. Brother Russell says, this two-horned beast, and this is from Roman numeral 9 of the fourth volume, the two-horned beast with horns like a lamb but voice like a dragon, we believe to represent the Church of England. Notice it's not the churches of Germany. Some have thought that that would be a good make for comparison with the Catholic Church, but we don't think so. Makes a claim, which the Church of Rome makes, that she is the true church. The original apostolic succession is hers. No one is commissioned to preach unless they have the apostolic succession. And we notice also that this would be preliminary to a church federation being bound together with the Catholic Church. Well, handout number 8, take a look at it, the gift of authority. This is not a full-blown discussion of this, but it does suggest that the Catholic Church and the Episcopal Church have moved together, where the Catholic Church and the Bishop of Rome is being given some sense of elevation by the clergy of the Anglican Church. Interestingly enough, there is a coziness there, which probably will even be more vivid in the near future. You know, I don't know that the Roman Curia and the Anglican Church have been reading the fourth volume or Revelation 13 for their script, but they seem to be following it pretty closely. In Revelation 13, 12 to 14, it says that the beast, the two-horned beast, will do wonders and miracles. Perhaps that will mean that they're going to help bring the Protestants back into the fold for the Roman Church. Maybe that's the miracle that someone will observe. But whatever the miracle is, there will be a strong delusion, as we heard earlier, because they did not have the truth and the love of it, where it could almost deceive the very elect. These could be the signs and wonders of Matthew 24, 24, that was mentioned also earlier in a different translation. The image of the Federation given life will be proscriptions, meaning you can't, and prescriptions, meaning you must. And this is what will happen when the buying and selling get limited. For example, no selling, no more witnessing. That could be proscribed unless you're part of this system. No buying, maybe not able to rent a hall like this because we're not part of the system, not involved with the, quote, officialness, the orthodoxy of the day. Maybe even proscribed from having radio, TV, or even internet. You know, a lot of us feel that we can do a lot of communicating on the internet. Wouldn't take much to pull the plug on that one. It would be affecting more than just ourselves, but it could happen. Now, what about the Orthodox churches? The Eastern Orthodox Church of Greece. Robert Stephanopoulos said these words. Eventually, the churches could resolve their ancient dispute over the Pope's jurisdiction. It could happen rather quickly in one respect, but quickly in respect to a 1,000-year separation is not necessarily immediately. I'm paraphrasing. The Russian church, look at number 10, please. A recent development has brought about the possibility of a rather exclusively separate Russian church. From the way it's been separate, bringing them back into the hands of the I need a different paper here. Just give me a sec. I mentioned about Putin before. Yeltsin and Putin have both moved closer to the Orthodox Church. And we mentioned also about the fact that there's a hostile environment as well as some desire to have some cooperation. This is very unusual and different. The Orthodox churches have basically kept their distance from Rome, but there seems to be a slight movement in the other direction. Now, we come to a point of time which I spoke about with the brethren at Puget Sound last year. And the next part of this, for those of you who have the internet, can be followed up by going to some of the websites that are mentioned. And I'm going to try to be very brief on this point, but I do want you to understand what it means and see the implications. I do not believe that these people will do what they expect to do. But nevertheless, in the trying to do it, they can do a lot of damage. A person who believes he has authority and wants to use that authority can be extremely harmful to society. Let's take a look at page number 11, your second paper, your third side. I'm going to have you just look with me at the document itself. This page opens up a question. If they're to rise to great prominence, as Brother Russell suggested in volume 4, page 3, what possibly could be going on now? In the United States and throughout the world, there's a group of Orthodox Presbyterians who feel that they should occupy till the Lord returns. You know how when the Lord goes away to a far country, he leaves his servants to with this responsibility to occupy. Well, they're interpreting this as they are to dominate, rule the church, rule for the church, the world, rule for Christ, as a church, the whole world. They are called dominionists. They are called Christian Reconstructionists. You can read this at your leisure, but the bottom line of it is this. These dominionists, rooted in Calvinism, have the idea that they should establish something called theonomy. They would like to undo the Constitution of the United States and have it allow for religion to be a requirement for office holding in the United States. That would be quite different than what the Constitution says. But they are out to try to do this, and 39 of them signed on to a bill proposing to remove that from the Constitution. I'm not coming up with this on my own. This is something that one can read. I do not recommend you look at all of these websites just like that. The one that's called theocracy.org or theocracywatch.org, I know that they're defensive about things that we would not be caring to see in the kingdom or anywhere else, but the fact is they also realize that not only those who are doing immoral acts that that these people would like to end and do so by execution, but they also believe that heretics would be subject to such behavior. So if you turn to the latter page, where it says we as Bible students are familiar with the cleansing of the sanctuary, we recognize that there is something that's happening with these people, these particular, shall we call them, dominionists, that they hope to bond together the churches who are they, what they would consider legitimate churches, bond them together and have law imposed in society. The law, as I mentioned, is theonomy. It means biblical law carried out to the nth degree. So, when they take, for example, this document in the middle of the page, number 6, we affirm essentially the Trinity, and they deny Arianism, among other things. They are telling us that if you are not in harmony with this, you really don't deserve to be around at all, because all you're going to do is provide us with problems. These people, in their own words, not from other people who don't like them, but in their own words, and you can read these things as per the internet down below, and or read them and or hear them and see them saying these words, they're talking about Constantine's connection with the church being the best thing that ever happened to the church. Calvin's Geneva was a great example of a church government, and that's the way things should be. And they're the people who gave us Michael Servetus roasting for hours. And the Salem folks who would be getting rid of witches, although there may be no witches. Oh, yes, they do. They have the Wiccans. They would probably want to kill them. All of this is what they'd like to do. Again, I don't think they're going to ever come to this point. But in the process, the bonding of them together will make for interesting communication between themselves and other churches. And they could make some things difficult for the true saints. And when I say difficult, I mean in the sense of the persecution that Brother Russell was looking at. So in terms of a lively, active crunching of the true church's future, it would be not different than if you were one of the brethren in Romania in your home with literature, and the police knock at the door, come in, take you, and they take you to prison, and on the way there, you lose your front teeth. I mean, this happened within our lifetime. We don't have that in America or United States or Canada. We don't have that. But they have had it in Eastern Europe. Brethren sent to prison for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. It's not something that's outside of the realm of possibility. And some of the brethren here who were in Canada went through hard times in the wars. You're familiar with that maybe more than I am. So, what's our responsibility with such ominous prophetic developments potentially in our future? And again, we might not see that. What's our attitude? What's our heart condition as these things develop? So regardless, really, of how we see things, I want to point out something about our heart attitude. I mentioned this to someone yesterday here, and I've mentioned it to brethren before. I fully believe that if I'm correct about all of these doctrinal points that I've learned with my other brethren we've studied with, if I'm completely correct about this, and there's a work to be done yet in the future by the true church, a closing work of the age, that if my heart is not right, the Lord will go like this: I don't need you. On the other hand, if your heart is right, and you don't happen to agree with this particular thing, that there is a work in the future, the Lord can teach you what he needs to teach you when he needs to teach it. And you will be used by the Lord. You will be blessed by the Lord because your heart is right. So I look at this in a we-they situation. I can see myself as failing, even though I believe it's right. I see my brethren having better hearts maybe than I do and being rewarded with privileges that I will never see. Because I may be not keeping my heart, but you are. This is important. We must be open to understanding what the Lord is doing, but most of all, we have to keep our hearts above all. What an incredible prospect is really before the true church. To be part of the new creation, the new Jerusalem, that will replace this ancient enemy of the true church, the false kingdom that is on earth, and there will be a kingdom that will bless all the families of the earth. The Lord bless you.